When we did the painter 2 weeks ago, we ended with 1 Nephi chapter 8. So let me go back there. Would you turn to 1 Nephi chapter 8? Let's start there. All right, 1 Nephi chapter 8. There are four groups of people in Lehi's dream. If you count up all the times that Lehi or Nephi says, I saw a group of people. So, and I've numbered them, you'll see why in a minute, but here's the first group. In verse 21, I saw numberless concourses of people. Those are the ones I call the threes. You'll see why in a minute. I saw numberless concourses of people. If you go a few verses later, in verse 24, he says, it came to pass that I beheld others. So now we're up to two groups of people. These are the ones I call the twos. A little bit later, in verse 30, to be short in writing, behold, I saw other multitudes. So now we're up to three groups of people. These are the ones I call the ones. And then, in verse 31, he saw other multitudes of people. So how many total groups has he seen? Four. And there's... I'm going to call this group four. So let me very briefly just point out. Well, we got to be quick. I got to be quicker than that. I'd love to spend a day and talk about 1 Nephi chapter 8, but this is C.S. Lewis. Four groups of people. Group four never make it to the tree, never grab the rod. They go straight to the building. Group three commence in the path. You'll notice that several times. They commence in the path. They commenced in the path. Multiple times it says they commenced in the path. But they never grab the rod. And they never make it to the tree. I would suggest there's a connection in Lehi's dream. No rod, no tree. Everyone who grabs the rod makes it to the tree. I think there's a powerful statement that in that. No rod, no tree. Those are the threes. The twos and the ones both grab the rod and make it to the tree. Now, the difference between the twos and the ones, so the threes never grab the rod and don't make it to the tree. And the last word describing the threes, they wandered off and were lost. Without a rod of iron in your life, you are susceptible to wandering off and getting lost. Contrast that with the twos. Now, the twos make it to the tree, but don't stay at the tree. The twos make it to the tree, but don't stay. And if you look at the last phrase describing the twos, it's not that they wander off and get lost. They do what? They fall away and get lost. The difference between the people who come to the tree and stay and the people who come to the tree and then fall away is this. Notice it says it twice. After they had partaken of the fruit of the tree, they cast their eyes about. They're looking. What do you think about me? After partaking of the tree, they cast their eyes about and were ashamed. What do you think of me? And they fall astray. Now, let me add to that, in Lehi's dream, Lehi describes this path that goes to the tree. But if we add Nephi and Lehi, there are three paths off the tree, or the path, the straight and narrow path. There are three diverting paths. There are three ways in Lehi's dream to go off the path. Now, the first one is pretty obvious. This is, I think, what we all recognize. What's the first path off the straight and narrow? The forbidden path. The path of sin. And why do many people leave the straight and narrow path? Sin. Sin tempts them off the path. Now, that's a subject for another day. It's the other two paths I want to watch. Lehi nailed this in 600 BC, and here we are living it. There are two other reasons people leave the straight and narrow path. Sin is the first one. Number two is described here. What is the name of the path that comes off the straight and narrow? The strange road. Now play with that imagery for a second. The strange road. Why do people act strangely? Why do they wear strange clothes and do strange things? What's the strange road? This is the strange road. This is the look at me road. I need you to notice me. I measure my value on what you think of me. So tell me how valuable I am. Like my page. Like my comments. Notice my hairstyle. Notice the way I dress. The more people that notice me, the more I am validated and I feel of worth. I need you to define who I am. So look at me. Now that was the painter, right? Why did the painter get back on the bus and go back to hell? Because people stopped looking at him. No one was noticed. He wanted to be a famous painter in heaven. And the whole idea is there are no famous painters in heaven. We paint for the glory of the light, not for the glory of the telling. That is the painter. And may I suggest, that is a very common thing we see today. I need you to notice me. So I will act differently. I will wear different clothing. I will pierce myself multiple times. I will change my hairstyle. I will drive certain things and live certain places. I will live a life so that you notice me. That's the strange road. And that's the painter who couldn't let go of that and got back on the bus and went back to hell. James?
Could you also potentially say that that's seeking value from things that can't bring that eternal value? It's like, I'm seeking to establish my identity by what I choose to do, not by what is right. Would you say that?
Yes, but I'd save that subject for another day. I think that's another idea. I would say doing those things for the praise of others is this group. So what's this last path? What's the other way that leads off the straight and narrow besides the I need you to notice me path? I'm going to act in such a way that draws your attention to me because I need you to see me. What's the other path? Now we need Nephi. So this is Lehi. Let's go to Nephi. Go to chapter 12. First Nephi 12 is where Nephi picks up the tree of life. Go to verse 17. 1 Nephi 12, 17. Nephi sees the third road. Tell me what it is. I didn't make this purple because I wanted it to be red. What's the third road here? What is it, Tim?
Kind of.
But what's the name of the road? I think I see where you're going. Hold on one second. What's the name of the road? The broad road. Now, why in the world are there broad roads? Why are there broad roads? Why do we make big, wide freeways and broad roads? So that a lot of people can go down them. This is the road of doing what everyone else is doing. In fact, this is the road of, I don't want you to see me. I can't be different. I can't stand out. I can't draw your attention. It terrifies me to be noticed. It's the opposite, right? But it's the same idea. I care what you think. This group is, I care what you think, so notice me. This group is, I care what you think, so don't notice me. I'm doing what everyone else is doing. I don't have the courage to be different. I can't stand up and say, no, I won't, because then you'll all notice me. I can't wear what others aren't wearing. So I will wear the inappropriate things because I don't have the courage to wear something else. I will use the language that they use because I don't have the courage to not use it. I don't want you to see me. Don't notice me. But where does that attitude take you? Now that is chapter 8. So let's go back into chapter 8, and then we're going to watch all of this come together in chapter 9, which concludes with the painter. So if you're joining us, if you're following along, this is Great Divorce, chapter 8. There's a lot that I want to skip. Okay, let's start here. Let me just start here. With no very clear plan in mind, I arose and began walking away from the river in the direction where the trees grew closest together. I had not fully made up my mind to go back to the bus, but I wanted to avoid open places. If only I could find a trace of evidence that it was really possible for a ghost to stay, that the choice was not only a cruel comedy, I would not go back. In the meantime, I went on, gingerly and keeping a sharp lookout. In about a half an hour, I came to a little clearing with some bushes in the center. As I stopped, wondering if I dared to cross it, I realized that I was not alone. So he gets to a group of trees in the middle of a clearing. A ghost hobbled across the clearing as quickly as it could on that uneasy soil, looking over its shoulder as if it were pursued. I saw that it had been a woman, a well-dressed woman. I thought, but its shadows of a finery looked ghastly in the morning light. It was making for the bushes. It could not really get in among them. The twigs and the leaves were too hard, but it pressed as close up against them as it could. It seemed to believe it was hiding. A moment later, I heard the sound of feet, and one of the bright people came in sight. One always noticed that sound there, for we ghosts made no noise when we walked. "Go away," squealed the ghost. "Go away. Can't you see I want to be alone?" "But you need help," said the solid one. "If you have the least trace of decent feeling left," said the ghost, "you'll keep away." "I don't want help. I want to be left alone. Do go away. You know I can't walk fast enough on those horrible spikes to get away from you. It's abominable of you to take advantage." "Oh, that," said the spirit, "that'll soon come right. But you're going in the wrong direction. It's back there to the mountains you need to go. You can lean on me all the way. I can't absolutely carry you, but you need have almost no weight on your feet. It will hurt less at every step. I'm not afraid of being hurt. You know that. Then what is the matter? Can't you understand anything? Do you really suppose I'm going out there among all those people like this? But why not? I've never come at all. I'd never have come at all if I'd known you were all going to be dressed like that. Friend, you see, I'm not dressed at all. I didn't mean that. Go away. But can't you even tell me? If you can't understand, there'd be no good trying to explain it. How can I go out like this among a lot of people with really solid bodies? It's far worse than going out with nothing on. It's far worse than going out with nothing on would have been on earth. Have everyone staring through me? Oh, I see. We were all a bit ghostly when we first arrived, you know. That'll wear off. Just come out and try. But they'll see me. What does it matter if they do? I'd rather die. But you've died already. There's no good trying to go back to that. The ghost made a sound, something between a sob and a snarl. I wish I'd never been born, it said. What are we born for? For infinite happiness, said the spirit. You can step out into it at any moment. But I tell you, they'll see me. An hour hence, and you will not care. A day hence, and you will laugh at it. Don't you remember on earth, there were things too hot to touch with your finger, but you could drink them all right? Shame is like that. If you will accept it, if you will drink the cup to the bottom, you will find it very nourishing. But try to do anything else, and it scalds. That's brilliant. You really mean, said the ghost and then paused. My suspense was strained up to the height. I felt that my own destiny hung on her reply. I could have fallen at her feet and begged her to yield. Yes, said the spirit. Come and try. Almost, I thought the ghost had obeyed. Certainly, it had moved. But suddenly it cried out, No, I can't. I tell you, I can't. For a moment while you were talking, I almost thought, but then it comes to the point. You've no right to ask me to do a thing like that. It's disgusting. I should never forgive myself if I did. Never, never. And it's not fair. They ought to have warned us. I'd never have come. And now, please, please, go away. Friend, said the spirit, could you only for a moment fix your mind on something not yourself. I've already given you my answer, said the ghost coldly but still tearful. Then only one expedient remains, said the spirit. And to my great surprise, he set a horn to his lips and blew. I put my hands over my ears. The earth seemed to shake. The whole wood trembled and dindled at his sound. I suppose there must have been a pause after that, though there seemed to be none, before I heard the thudding of hoofs. Far off at first, but already nearer before I had well identified it, and soon near that I began to look about for some place of safety. Before I had found one, the danger was all about us. A herd of unicorns came thundering through the glades. 27 hands high, the smallest of them, and white as swans, but for the red gleam in eyes and nostrils and flaring indigo of their horns. I can still remember the squelching noise of the soft, wet turf under their hoofs, the breaking of the undergrowth, the snorting and the whinnyings, how their hind legs went up and their horned heads down in mimic battle. Even then I wondered for what real battle it might be, the rehearsal. I heard the ghosts scream, and I think it made a bolt away from the bushes, perhaps towards the spirit, but I don't know. For my own nerve fell, and I fled. Not the heeding for the moment, the horrible going underfoot, and not once daring to pause. So I never saw the end of that interview. Why the blowing of the horns and the unicorns? Tim?
I think it shows that, like, no matter what that spirit was going, the ghost was going to be noticed. It was the choice between the two. He chose wrong, so he had to have the humiliation part to be, like, sent back to the bus when he could have chosen to get over it. And so no matter what, that was going to happen, but it was all how he was going to let it happen or if it was going to happen.
Good. I like that. Interesting perspective. Anyone else? Why the unicorns? What's the whole point? A woman who doesn't want to be seen, who's not dressed appropriately. I'm not good enough. I don't want you to see me. And then suddenly, a host of unicorns. The unicorns, I believe, were an invitation to face your fear and come out and be exposed. Instead, what do you think she did? She ran. She ran and hid. Now, that is a powerful commentary on, do you care what they think? What if they don't like you? What if they laugh? What if they mock? What if you're different? Can you stand it? Can you stand to be different? To be noticed for reasons you didn't want to be noticed? Do you have the courage to stand up and say, I don't care if I'm different? Do you see the juxtaposition of those two in chapters 8 and then chapter 9 with the painter? And yet Nephi and Lehi nailed that in the Book of Mormon to say, here's what leads people off the path. Sin will lead you off the path. Being tempted to sin will pull you off the path. But so also will caring what people think. Both directions. I want you to be seen. I want you to see me. And I'm terrified of you seeing me. So, the main character is just kind of sitting here shaking his head. Let's read chapter 9 so that you can see the discovery of what this is all about. I'm going to skip the first part just until George shows up. On one of the rocks sat a very tall man, almost a giant, with a flowing beard. I had not yet looked on the solid people in the face. Now when I did so, I discovered that one sees them with a kind of double vision. Here was an enthralled and shining god whose ageless spirit weighed upon mine like a burden of solid gold. Yet at the very same moment, here was an old, weather-beaten man, one who might have been a shepherd. Such a man as tourists think simple because he is honest and neighbors think deep for the same reason. His eyes had the far-seeing look of one who has lived a long, long in open, solitary places, and somehow I divined the network of wrinkles which must have surrounded them before rebirth had washed them into immortality. Oh, wait, I forgot the question. Where are you going? I don't quite know, said I. Ye can sit and talk with to me then, he said, making room for me on the stone. "I don't know, sir," said I, taking my seat beside him. "My name is George," he said, "George MacDonald." "Oh," I cried, "then you can tell me. You at least will not deceive me." Then, supposing that these expressions of confidence needed some explanation, I tried, trembling, to tell this man all that his writings had done for me. I would have the same moment if C.S. Lewis came up and said, "Hey, I'm C.S. Lewis." One day my wife and I went to see Elder Neil A. Maxwell. We got there early and we're in the lobby, and a man tapped me on the shoulder, and I turned around and said, "Hello, I'm Neil Maxwell." I just froze. And I thought of this line: "I trembled to tell this man all that his writings had done for me." I tried to tell how a certain frosty afternoon at Leatherwood Station, when I first bought a copy of Fantastes, being then about 16 years old, had been to me what the first sight of Beatrice had been to Dante. Her beginnings, here begins the new life. I started to confess how long that life had delayed in the region of imagination merely, how slowly and reluctantly I'd come to admit that his Christendom had more than an accidental connection with me, how hard I had tried not to see that the true name of the quality which first met me in his books is holiness. He laid his hand on mine and stopped me. "Son," he said, "your love, all love, is of inexpressible value to me. But it may save precious time." Here he suddenly looked very Scottish. "If I inform ye that I am already well acquainted with these biographical details. In fact, I have noticed that your memory misleads you in one or two particulars." "Oh," said I, and became still. "Ye had started," said my teacher, "to talk of something more profitable." "Fancy way, what's going on?" George MacDonald says, "Let's not talk about me." I love that. I'm aware of what I've done in your life, and you've kind of forgotten a few details, but let's not talk about me." "Sir," said I had almost forgotten, and I have no anxiety about the answer now, though I still have a curiosity. It's about these ghosts. Do any of them stay? Can they stay? Is any real choice offered to them? How do they come to be here? Now that's something we need to pause. Can you get out of the past? Can you get out of the celestial and come into the terrestrial? What if you've made lots of mistakes? Can you really be forgiven? Can you really get out of hell and stay in heaven? Did ye never hear of refrigerium? A man with your advantage might have read it. I'm going to skip most of these. Excursions to this country. For those that will take them, of course, most of the silly creatures don't. They prefer taking trips back to Earth. They go and play tricks on the poor daft women they call mediums. They go and try to assert their ownership of some house that once belonged to them. And then we get what's called a haunting. Or they go to spy on their children, or literary ghosts hang about public libraries to see if anyone's still reading their books. But if they come here, can they really stay? Aye. Ye'll have heard that the Emperor Trajan did. But I don't understand. Is judgment not final? Is there really a way out of hell into heaven? What's our answer to that question? Absolutely. Just let go of what's keeping you there. We believe hell has an exit, and anyone who wants to can exit as soon as they let go. Is judgment not final? Is there really a way out of hell into heaven? It depends on the way you're using the words. If they leave that gray town behind, it will not have been hell. To any that leaves it, it's purgatory. And perhaps ye had better not call this country heaven. Not deep heaven, ye understand. Here he smiled at me. Ye can call it the valley of the shadows of life. And yet to those who stay here, it will have been heaven from the first. And ye can call those sad streets and the town yonder the valley of the shadow of death. But to those who remain there, they will have been hell from the very beginning. I suppose he saw that I looked puzzled for the present, for presently he spoke again. Son, he said, ye cannot in your present state understand eternity. When Enaudos looked through the door of the timeless, he brought no message back. But you can get some likeness of it if you say that both good and evil, when they are full grown, become retrospective. Not only this valley, but all their earthly past will have been heaven to those who are saved. Not only the twilight of that town, but all their life on earth too will then be seen by the damned to have been hell. That is what mortals misunderstand. They say of some temporal suffering, no future bliss can make up for it. Not knowing that heaven once attained will work backwards and turn even that agony into a glory. And of some sinful pleasure, some say, let me but have this and I will take the consequences. Little dreaming how damnation will spread back and back into their past and contaminate the pleasure of the sin. Both processes begin even before death. The good man's past begins to change so that his forgiven sins and remembered sorrows take on the quality of heaven. The bad man's past already conforms to his badness and is filled only with dreariness. And that is why in the end of all things, when the sun rises here and the twilight turns to blackness down there, the blessed will say, we have never lived anywhere except in heaven. And the lost will say, we have always been in hell. And both will speak truly. That is one of the most profound concepts C.S. Lewis has ever taught me. After I read this, I saw it all over the gospel. But that idea, they're in hell. They've created that hell. All they have to do is let go, and everything changes. Heaven once obtained will convert all of your memories of pain. Jesus explained it in the New Testament as a woman who gives birth. A woman, when she's giving birth, is in travail, he said, because her hour has come. But what happens the moment the baby is handed to that mother? She remembers no more the pain because the joy of a child has entered the world. That's what mortality is. We need to understand that concept. That heaven works backwards, and when you obtain the glory of heaven, it changes every pain into joy. You will go back and conclude, my whole life was heaven. Once that glory is obtained and works backwards. But the same thing is true of hell. My whole life was hell. My whole life was miserable. Because hell once obtained works backwards and corrupts everything and gives you the conclusion. Let me give you an example in modern life. Let me use Nephi and Laman. Looking back, so here's Nephi, here's Laman, looking back on the same 8 years. You remember what happened during those 8 years, right? Looking back on the same 8 years. Now, this is how Nephi saw it. This is what heaven does. This is what the Spirit does. This is what Holy Ghost does. This is what time with God does. Looking back on the 3 years, tell me what Nephi sees. So great were the blessings of the Lord upon us that, yeah, we had a few challenges. We had to eat raw meat, but we were tough. Our women nursed their babies like no problem, and they did a lot of hard work. Yeah, it was a little, but so great were the blessings, it was nothing. Now, Laman looks back on the same 8 years, and what does he say? It was so bad. Let's start here. He hath led us out of the land of Jerusalem, and we've wandered in the wilderness these many years, and our women have toiled and been big with child, and they have borne children in the wilderness and suffered all things save it were death. And it would have been better to die than to come out and have to suffer these periods. So one person looks back and sees what? It was so good. And one person looks back and says, it was so bad. And they're looking at the very same things. And the reason is because when Nephi got here, the joy changed his view of his past. It turned his pain into joy. And Laman, his misery turned every possible thing into misery. So back to C.S. Lewis. Can we really stay? Can anyone really stay? Is that not very hard, sir? I mean, that is the real sense of what they will say in the actual language of the lost. The worlds will be different, no doubt. One will say that he has always served his country right or wrong, and another that he has sacrificed everything to his art, and some that they've been taken in. And some, thank God, they've always looked after number one. And nearly all, that, at least they've been true to themselves. And the saved? Ah, the saved. What happens to them is best described as the opposite of a mirage. What seemed when they entered it to be the veil of misery turns out when they look back to have been a well. And where present experiences saw only salt deserts, memory truthfully records that they were pools full of water. Then those people are right who say that heaven and hell are only states of mind. Hush, he said sternly, do not blaspheme. Hell is a state of mind. Ye never said a truer word. And every state of mind left to itself, every shutting up of the creature within the dungeon of its own mind is in the end hell. But heaven is not a state of mind. Heaven is reality itself. All that is fully real is heavenly. For all that can be shaken will be shaken, and only the unshakable remains. Jacob used the phrase, things as they really are. But there is a real choice after death. My Roman Catholic friends would be surprised, for to them, souls in purgatory are already saved. And my Protestant friends would like it no better, for they'd say that the tree lies as it falls. They're both right, maybe. Do not fash yourself with such questions. You cannot fully understand the relations of choice and time till you are beyond both. and we were not brought here to study such curiosities. What concerns you in the nature of the choice itself, and that we can, no, what concerns you is the nature of the choice itself, and that we can watch them making. Well, sir, I said, that also needs explaining. What do they choose? These souls that go back? I have yet seen no others. And how can they choose it? Milton was right, said my teacher. The choice of every lost soul can be expressed in the words, better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. There is always something they insist on keeping, even at the price of misery. There is always something they prefer to joy, that is, to reality. They see, you see it easily enough in a spoiled child that would sooner miss its play and its supper than say it was sorry and be friends. You call it sulks. But an adult life has 100 fine names. Achilles' wrath. You can read those. Let's skip. Let's move on. Then is no one lost through the undignified vices, sir? Through more sensuality? Some are, no doubt. The sensualist, I'll allow you, begins by pursuing a real pleasure, though a small one. His sin is the last, but the time comes on when, though the pleasure becomes less and less, and the craving fiercer and fiercer, and though he knows that joy can never come that way, yet he prefers to joy the mere fondly of an unappeasable lust and would not have it taken from him. He'd fight to the death to keep it. And he'd like well to be able to scratch, but even when he can scratch no more, he'd rather itch than not. Fancy way of saying, I got to be careful with this because I don't want you to interpret this. Sin isn't the problem. Sin isn't the problem here. The problem is sinning and then discovering it doesn't make you happy. And yet still sinning. It's not the sin that's a problem. It's you not waking up to the reality that that is not how you want to live. And continuing to hold on to the sin, even though it brings you no pleasure. Now, don't get me wrong, sin is bad. But the idea is a fascinating idea to talk about. In this mortal life, does the Lord allow us to make stupid choices? It's not the stupid choices that's the problem. It's continuing to hold on to the stupid problem, the stupid choices, instead of waking up and saying, this is a dumb thing I'm doing and I need to change. If I wake up and say, this is not making me happy, this is stupid, this is dumb, why do I keep doing this and then change? What will the sin have done to you? A negative or a positive thing? And I know we have a tendency, sin is bad, and it is. I don't want to say it's not. But tasting the sin is not the problem. Tasting the sin, realizing it didn't make you happy, and still sinning is the problem. That's the mistake people in hell make. They never break the cycle of, this is dumb. I am grateful for the dumb things I've done. I would like to sometimes say, I wish I would have lived a life without making dumb decisions. But if I really could go back in time and change the dumb decisions I've made, would I be the person I am today? The dumb decisions defined me. The dumb decisions made me who I am. And my current state of change and repentance erases the dumb decisions. It's heaven obtained goes back and fixes the past. We shouldn't be ashamed so much about the dumb things we've done. We should be ashamed if you've never woken up and realized you're doing dumb things and they don't make you happy. Why do I keep doing dumb things? That's the problem. This whole book is to say you are holding on to something that you don't even like to do. But you can't let it go. It is not a source of happiness for you, and you know it. But you can't let it go. And the only people who stay are the people who wake up and say, I'm letting go of this. This is dumb. This is not how I want to live. You see what he's trying to say? James.
And then would you also say there's the argument to understanding that it's like, oh, I'm not already having that knowledge of that will make me happy? Because like with President Oaks, how he talked about, I think it was President Oaks with the manure. How he's like, what if I go taste cigarettes? He's like, what if you go taste manure? You know, he's like, you'll know it's already bad.
Yeah.
Like, you know it's gross, so why would you go do it?
Yeah.
So there's also, would you say there's the point to it's like, well, there's some things you know won't bring happiness.
Yes. Yes. And being wise and saying, I'm not going to do things that are stupid. I think the mistake that so many of us make, though, is first of all, we beat ourselves up for having made mistakes. We beat ourselves up for having done dumb things instead of realizing that letting go of the dumb thing was the smartest thing I did. Having done a dumb thing, realizing it's a dumb thing, letting go of the dumb thing is actually the best thing I've ever done in my life. Much better, I would say. Now, bear with me. You got to balance this. Much better than to have never done the dumb thing in the first place. That's what he's trying to teach. Now, let me just skip ahead for the sake of time. Let me go here. Ye will understand that better perhaps before you go, said he. In the meantime, I must tell ye that they have come further for the sake of the ghosts than you can understand. Every one of us lives only to journey further and further into the mountains. Every one of us has interpreted that journey and retraced immeasurable distances to come down today on the mere chance of saving some ghost. Of course, it is also joy to do so, but ye cannot blame us for that. It would be no use to come further, even if it were possible. The sane would do no good if they made themselves mad to help madmen. But what of the poor ghosts who never get into the omnibus at all? Everyone who wishes it does. Let me repeat that. What about the poor ghosts who never get on the bus to come to heaven? Are they just stuck in hell? Everyone that wishes it does. Now, forgive me if I go big here. What about people who spent their whole life living the celestial law and end up in the celestial kingdom? Are they stuck there? Now, I need to be careful because the official doctrine we have from the First Presidency regarding, you know, getting out. So here's the king, here's the telestial, here's the terrestrial, and here's the celestial. People want to say, well, can I go from telestial to terrestrial? Can I go from terrestrial to celestial? Is there inter-kingdom advancement? And the official statement from the First Presidency is, we can't say yes and we can't say no. We can't say no, that no telestial person will ever leave the telestial kingdom. But we also can't say yes. So don't just be lazy on this life and think that eventually you can get to the celestial kingdom. But the point here I want to say is, does that mean people stuck in hell, stuck in the celestial kingdom, are stuck in the celestial kingdom? No. Everyone who wishes to be here comes here. Never fear. There are only two kinds of people in the end. Those who say to God, "Thy will be done." And those to whom God says in the end, "Thy will be done." All that are in hell, choose it. All that are in a celestial kingdom, choose it. No one gets stuck in the celestial kingdom. No one gets accidentally assigned the celestial kingdom. There are no mistakes. Those who end up in a celestial kingdom choose it. Those who end up in a terrestrial kingdom choose it. All that are in hell choose it. Without that self-choice, there could be no hell. No soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it. And if I could testify from the rooftops, there is no blessing you crave, righteously crave, that won't be yours someday. No soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it. Those who seek, find. Those who knock, it is opened. I just would shout that from the rooftops. This is where they get interrupted with the mother and the son, which we'll pick up next week. But I love, you get the kingdom you seek. But don't make the stupid mistake of just out of habit holding on to lesser things. If you have ever tasted a lesser thing, if you've ever grabbed a celestial thing and it hurt you, and then you let it go and said, "I don't want to touch that anymore," and you never picked it up again, that was the blessing. To now walk away and say, "I know where I want to go." It is my witness to every single one of you that you will go where you seriously and constantly want to go. If you desire celestial things, if you truly desire celestial things, no soul that seriously and constantly desires celestial things will miss the celestial kingdom. And so I leave you again with this from President Oakes. I think he said it so powerfully. We have a loving Heavenly Father who will see that we receive every blessing and every advantage that our own desires and choices allow. If there's a lesser thing you've picked up and you're holding on to, be wise enough to say, "This doesn't make me happy," and let it go. Everyone that wants to can stay in heaven. All they have to do is let go and stop desiring it. What you truly desire will be granted. Of that I testify in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.